Alice Fearing is a James Beard Award-winning journalist with a nose for wine who began to notice a rush of wines being made to suit the palate of one very powerful wine critic. She wrote a book about her journey to highlight the state of winemaking around the world today, and it's called The Battle for Wine and Love, or How I Saved the World from Parkerization. She was a guest on my show this summer, and we are playing that again for you now. Alice Fearing began her book with a beautiful passage about one of her earlier memorable experiences with wine, so I started out by asking her how that first sip of Barolo affected her.
Well, going back to 1980, it was that defining moment that separated everything else that I ever drank up to that point and opened up another door where I realized it was probably at that point, even though I was only 14 years old, it had a tremendous nuance, complexity. It just kept on going. It was the light bulb went off. It was
and
forever
that
different.
That wine was made by Giovanni Scannavino, even. He has wine in his name. Was that his best wine, that 68 Barolo? Because some of his later wines got some pretty bad reviews.
In fact, most of his wines got pretty bad reviews, and I found that actually pretty remarkable. But that was the one year that did get some kind remarks. He was a big industrial producer.
So he accidentally made a great wine? Is that what happened?
From what I found out, there was a period of time when he had his own vineyards before he went bankrupt and they had to send them off. And this must have been one of those years when he was working with his own vines.
Are there still authentic Barolos being made?
There are indeed. There are indeed. Not too many, but there are several.
So what is a natural wine by your definition?
I'm trying to figure out a way where I don't define it with it doesn't have, it's not made with, but it will be made with its own native yeast, not any inoculation, no designer yeast use, no enzymes that will affect its flavor or color, no added tannins addition. Basically, it's nothing but grapes, and then the winemaker tries to interfere with it as little as possible, including the overuse, not using the overuse of oak.
So would it be organic by definition, and would it be unfiltered? As I sometimes I see on a label of wine, unfiltered, although I don't know what that means and whether that's necessarily something good.
Well, unfiltered and unfined has been quite popular because of Mr. Parker's
Robert Parker's
yes.
name comes up. Okay.
Yes, but as far as the organic viticulture, for me, I kind of start there. I start with no chemical farming because it really does make a difference. And the more and more you taste, the more, especially when you taste grapes off the vine, you see it makes a tremendous difference.
Now, what do all of these things that you don't want to see, these introduced yeast, the enzymes, the wood chips and whatever, what do they do to the taste and why is that necessarily bad?
Well, it predetermines what the market wants as opposed to what the vine and the place has to say. And the reason that Barolo shocked me into wine existence was because it really spoke to me about a place where if you're going to the mass market wants a big wine that has oaky flavors and strong tannin or vanilla, cherry vanilla, all that kind of stuff, then you're basically saying, okay, we're going to make this wine like any other cookie cutter product.
Is wine going through the same kind of process that we've seen with other foods? Because right now, when a lot of people are insisting on foods that are local, that don't go through a lot of processing, but it seems to me that wines are now where perhaps other foods were 20 or 30 years ago.
Exactly, 20 or 30 years ago. In fact, I think that a lot of us, maybe because, well, I imagine mostly because of lack of editorial on the topic, just are accepting a level of manipulation in our wine that we would never accept in our food.
Is this something that's happening just in this country or all over the world?
It's kind of started as far as the resurgence of the natural wine movement. The natural wine movement is extremely powerful in France, which is where it originated about 20 years ago and now is getting a lot of force behind it.
So natural wine returning to the old ways.
Yes, exactly.
And there was a movie a few years ago called Mondavino, mm-hmm. which complained about all of the, sometimes unfairly, about all of the manipulation of wines. And it named the same person you name as the villain. Now, not everybody thinks Robert Parker is a force for evil. And some say he has one of the most remarkable palates that you could ever have.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel a little uncomfortable with saying that I make Robert Parker the villain.
Your subtitle is Parkerization.
Parkerization, which is very different from Parker. And it is not necessarily Robert Parker's fault that mass marketers of the wine universe have decided that his palate sells, so we're going to make wine to suit his palate. It's not quite his fault.
So what he does is he rates wine, and then we have the option of going out and listening to his ratings, mm-hmm. or not. Mm-hmm. But what happened is when he rated wines highly, and you even seen wine ads that say RP 92 or something like that. Mm-hmm. That means you should buy this wine.
Exactly.
Then winemakers took notice, and they were getting a 78, even though some people might have thought their wines were good.
Mm-hmm.
So they did everything to get their 95, 96.
Exactly. And before all of this, there used to be a great variety in the weight and the flavors of wine. Delicate used to be a positive. Not now anymore.
So you spoke to Robert Parker. What did he? How did he react when you asked him about traditional winemaking?
Well, I found out that we had a very different idea of what traditional was, and actually using the word traditional might be a dangerous term to use. So for Robert Parker, traditional was old grapes, old varietals. And for me, it was a way of making wine. So he's just talking about, so you don't plant Cabernet in Rioja, and you don't plant a Sauvignon Blanc in,
Burgundy.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
which you can't anyway, because it is against the law in France.
Well, actually, one little town does make it.
But I understand. In other words,
yeah, exactly.
He's saying you don't go against the old traditions,
exactly.
But you're saying we should go back to the old ways. Are you saying we should be stomping the wines with our feet all of that?
No, but there's certainly plenty that are foot stomped that I love. But that's fine not to.
Now, he insisted to you that his tastes weren't influencing the market. Could you convince him otherwise?
No, and I don't even know whether convincing him was necessarily the point of the conversation, but I think we both lost our tempers at that point.
My guest is Alice Feiring, F-E-I-R-I-N-G. She's written a book called The Battle for Wine and Love, or How I Saved the World from Parkerization, published by Harcourt. Ms. Feiring has written for Food and Wine. In fact, her blog in Vino Veritas was named one of the 7 best by Food and Wine. She's also written for Time and New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle, and Condé Nast Traveler. So why don't you have the kind of clout that Robert Parker has?
Well,
maybe he's really promoting something that has a wide public appeal.
Well, Robert, I never thought to have that audience in the first place. In the second, he's been at it for a really long time, and he wasn't necessarily an overnight success.
Haven't things been changing in this country for years? The French talked about how important the soil was and the microclimate and all of that. And in California, we had people saying, you can make a wine any way you want simply through technology. Mm-hmm. In more recent years, we've been hearing about California winemakers going biodynamic and worrying about where they plant what grapes. So haven't they been returning to the old ways?
Well, actually, the concept of terroir is kind of controversial in California, where some people would like to deny that it exists and it's not at all important. There are some people who are finally beginning to look at site, and maybe, speaking of Sauvignon Blanc, maybe it doesn't grow so well in Sonoma in the desert. But that is new. And I was doing a reading in Healdsburg a couple of weeks ago, and a winemaker shocked me by saying, whether or not there's terroir in California is still to be determined.
Really?
And I thought that was really revolutionary.
Now, have things changed in California? Because, in 1976, Stephen Spurrier, an English wine merchant in Paris, had this famous blind tasting, and 2 California wines, a California white and a California red, won. The French who chose them as the best wines in the tasting were outraged that they'd been tricked. But still, they were chosen the best wines.
I think back in 1976, California was making wine of a different sort. And that was pre-irrigation and pre a lot of these techniques that I rail out against. Also, it was the Dark Ages in France. There was a lot of chemicalizing of the soil. They were doing a lot of manipulation. The wines were thin and reedy, and, America really showed them a good time.
So we forced them to improve.
At the same
time, we've gone into decline, is what you're saying?
I think whenever you pander, when you go after the market, there is going to be a loss of authenticity, and the wines will falter.
You devote a chapter to discussing the changes occurring in Rioja in Spain. Now, the Rioja wines were mostly made by French winemakers who were escaping a terrible blight on French vines in the end of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And they made these incredible wines, mostly reds. Mm-hmm. Are they no longer good?
They're different. And the reason that I embarked on a journey in Rioja was after reading some of Robert Parker's favorite Riojas, and the description sounded like Cabernet. It didn't sound like any of my memories of Rioja, so I went in to see what was going on.
Of course, Riojas were originally made by people who'd left Bordeaux,
right,
where they had made Cabernet,
exactly.
So wasn't that part of their goal?
To make a wine that tasted
was like,
French?
Well, yes, well, in Spain.
Since I wasn't there in the late 1800s, I'm not exactly sure, but what they made, they used very different oak. They were using American oak back in then. They weren't using French oak. And they seemed to have made a wine very much of the place, which back then I think you only could.
Mm. And you say there's been a real decline in white Rioja.
Yes, white Rioja, like Lopez de Heredia, which is still making a very traditional white wine that's long-aged. It's all very, now modern white Riojas, when you can find them, are very fresh. They're inoculated, so they don't smell anything like the grape.
So what happens? There are a few winemakers everywhere, mm-hmm, who are making wines the way they used to make them.
Mm-hmm.
Are their wines more expensive than the others?
Often they're less expensive, paradoxically.
So the real trick is to just know who's doing what?
And how do you do that? That's an excellent question. Yes, you do have to just know who's doing what, because you're not going to be able to find it on the label.
Does this mean I have to read wine magazines all the time?
Yeah, or email me like the rest of the world does.
Well, if are there wine shops in New York that are particularly good?
Yes, there are. A personal favorite is Chambers Street Wine and Spirits, or is Chambers Street Wines. Is it Wine and Spirits?
It's all the way over on the west side.
Yeah, on Chambers Street. There are several little ones that are cropped up. Appalachian does a really good job. Discovery does. The Astor has a lot of good selections as well.
And will the people who are working there know whether a specific wine is made in the old way?
At Chambers, Discovery and Appalachian for sure.
I looked at your champagne selections. They were all champagne makers I never heard of. Does that mean that the best stuff usually is from smaller makers?
For champagne, I really, especially right now, I'm very convinced of this. Maybe 7 years ago, I would be a great believer in Krug and some of the other large houses. And also, I do like Bollinger, and Paul Roger does a nice job. But the most expressive champagnes do come from the best of the small growers.
And is that true for these others as well? Are there any large winemakers who are making it the good old-fashioned way?
The good old-fashioned way. It does, when you're doing tremendous amount of bottles, it does get harder to do it more artisanally. But yeah, Camille Giroux, and as far as Burgundy, I'm trying to think of some other very large names. Oh, of course, Louis Jadot, mm-hmm, great believer in biodynamics, and Jacques Laudier is phenomenal.
Can you explain biodynamics?
That's a tough one. But I explain it as an uber-organic approach with a link towards spirituality. So, or kind of the homeopathic view to taking care of your soil.
Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of... many winemakers have told me, probably some whose wines you don't approve of, that really winemaking is all about farming.
Right. That is what any winemaker will tell you. And that was actually one of the things that motivated me to write the book, is that, like, how many times am I going to hear that? And I see gorgeous stuff going on in the vineyard. Then I go in the winery and I see the reverse osmosis machines and the micro ox, and I see the bags
where they, where they add extra oxygen,
right,
to the wine to...
to smooth it out, because the public wants a smooth wine. I don't agree with that, but yes, that's what they think.
So the complaint is that at one point, wines were all very distinctive. Each winemaker made something quite different. Mm-hmm. Now they're all tending to taste the same.
Exactly.
But a counter argument is that the quality standards are much higher today. You're not going to get the really awful stuff you used to get.
Right. So you could say that the bar has been raised a bit, but the moments of greatness don't happen quite as often.
Well, but isn't it okay if we just know that when we go to the store, we're going to get a decent bottle of wine?
If that's what excites you, yes. I do look for something different, though. But it is nice to know that there is more wine out there that is palatable. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what are you writing for these days other than your blog?
I'm doing a wine bar story for the L.A. Times. I'm doing a Bordeaux story for Departures.
And in L.A., do they consider you to be the enemy or a friend?
I was just very surprised that I'm not the enemy. I really was. I've been doing a lot of readings out there, and there was one reading at the Ferry Plaza when the audience was very, very sober, and I stopped reading and I said, "Did you guys read that story I wrote for the LA Times about how I hate California wines and do you hate me?" And that kind of cracked them up. But mostly, a lot of winemakers have come out with a lot of support and a lot of drinkers as well.
Do you see good wines coming from South America, from New Zealand, from Australia? You said the French are returning, at least some of them,
yes,
to the old ways.
There's a phenomenal amount of great wine out of France. And actually, I'm seeing more movement coming out of California, not New World.
Alice Fiering's book, The Battle for Wine and Love, or How I Save the World from Parkerization, is published by Harcourt. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.